Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, a Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 315 on Friday, August 15th, 2014. It's a little breezy down by the shore itself. I think maybe you can hear the waves in the background, but I'm up here on the dune. And it's a gray day here. We've had a big rainstorm the other night. It was really exciting. The rain was just pouring down on these old cottages, making them thrum like a drum. And then the next day, yesterday, was all fresh, really gorgeous. It's always different here, and it's just great to have some time to spend here at the beach. Let's head up to the cottage, and I'll tell you about this week's show. Via the magic of Skype and pretty decent internet service here at the cottage in Ocean Park, Maine, I was able to connect with author Jason Bogue at his office on the West Coast for this week's interview. He has a new book out, Born Reading, that grew out of his desire to introduce his infant daughter, Olive, to the joys of reading amidst today's dizzying choices of technologies, from paper to a jungle of captivating and colorful electronic screens.
I knew then that I had come up with a pretty good mix. Like, I knew she had a print book she liked, and I knew she had an audiobook that she liked, and I knew she had something on the iPad that she could do that would help expand that experience.
In news, Amazon and Purdue University have announced an innovative partnership that will save students at the West Lafayette, Indiana school some serious money on textbooks. For the tech tips, I will share some things about Amazon's video chat Mayday tech support you may not know, and in content, we'll look at a list of great children's books. First up in news, Purdue University in Indiana this week announced in concert with Amazon that it has become the second U.S. university to join what is now being called the Amazon Campus Program. The first was the University of California, Davis, which announced a pilot project with Amazon last fall. Students, faculty, employees, alumni, and friends of Purdue can now navigate to purdue.amazon.com and their web browsers to shop the full amazon.com selection, generating an unspecified percentage commission that will benefit Purdue's scholarship programs. In the UC Davis pilot, a similar arrangement provides that university with a little more than 2% on most purchases from the university-branded store. That's according to an article by Carl Stramsheim at InsideHigherEd.com. There will also be savings on textbooks. In the Purdue release, it estimated that at 30% of current textbook costs, and there will be staffed physical locations on the Purdue campus for placing orders, receiving Amazon items that have been purchased, and also dropping off rented textbooks when they're due. The UC Davis pilot project, by comparison, uses bright yellow automated Amazon lockers, apparently with no staffing. Inside Higher Ed said the Purdue Student Store gives students a priority lane to Amazon and shows that the company is aiming for more visibility on college campuses. Expansion plans to other colleges are reportedly in the works. We're going to hear more about this program in next week's interview with Ripley McDonald, Amazon's Director of Student Programs, who is working closely with the Amazon Campus Initiatives. When I was an undergraduate at Harvard many years ago, we bought our textbooks at the Harvard Cooperative Society, the Harvard Coop, now owned by Barnes & Noble. You don't see Barnes & Noble insignia anywhere in the store, but they were selling Nooks back in the day. So I'm sure that the Amazon Campus Initiative is not good news for the beleaguered Barnes & Noble book chain. That said, I suspect that Harvard's decision makers will be mindful of the hot button that Amazon represents in places like Cambridge, Massachusetts. You can get a feel for the potential backlash by reading. There are just four comments left at the Inside Higher Ed story, but they were all anti-Amazon, two of them referencing the ongoing dispute with Hachette. I would think that Princeton might be a logical next step for Amazon Campus, given that its alumni include both Jeff Bezos and Russ Grandinetti, Senior Vice President for Kindle Content, and probably a good number of other executives at Amazon. The Purdue store includes lots of items that celebrate the Boilermakers, I guess that's what they're known as at Purdue, from dolls to chairs to blankets. So if you are part of the Purdue Boilermaker family, you might want to check it out at purdue.amazon.com. Another news item this week underscored the declining fortunes of physical bookstores. Publishers Weekly reported on August 13th that bookstore sales for the first 6 months of this year were down 7.9% compared with the same period last year. That's according to preliminary estimates released by the U.S. Census Bureau. The data for bookstores showed their sales fell every month during the first half of the year, including a 7.5 year-over-year decline for June. By comparison, sales for the total retail sector rose 3.6% for the six-month period, including a 4.2% rise in June. I'm not really surprised at this data, despite anecdotal reports that independent bookstores are doing better and the number of members of the American Booksellers Association is reported to be rising. I'm sure that some bookstores are figuring out a way to remain destinations for literary events and community gatherings, as well as a place just to buy books and increasingly non-book gift items. But I think the overall trend is pretty clearly away from brick-and-mortar stores to online shopping and, of course, toward digital reading. For the first tech tip, I want to pass along some details of the May Day video chat support available for Kindle Fire HDX and Fire Phone devices. I've talked about this impressive customer service from Amazon a lot, and I continue to be impressed with how easy it is to solve problems that come up on my new Fire Phone using the May Day button. I came across a frequently asked questions for May Day, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at thekindlechronicles.com. It's kind of a well-done FAQ. It has an informal tone. One of the questions was, is this your attempt to compensate for not having a Genius Bar? Now, that's a reference, of course, to the way that Apple handles much of its tech support by letting people make online appointments at Apple stores for help at the Genius Bar. I think you can just go in and line up if you're willing to wait and get a shot at the Genius Bar. But Amazon's answer to this cheeky self-imposed question was, quote, no, this is a completely new approach to tech support. You get your own personal tech advisor from the comfort of your home or office. That's a succinct way of stating the advantages of May Day. And of course, May Day tech advisors are available 24/7, 365 days a year at no extra charge. If you want to call Apple for help on devices that you buy from them, you need to sign up for Apple Care when you buy your device. I think you get 30 days of phone help before that. But if you pay $249 for, this is on the MacBook Air, which I use, that gets you 3 years of coverage where you do get excellent phone support with your computer. Not 24/7, though, and not on holidays. The FAQ also notes that May Day is available internationally. I didn't realize that. This is for Amazon.com and Amazon.UK customers. In other words, if you have an address registered in those two countries, you can get support when you travel abroad, but the support is available only in English at this point. Another tip I want to pass along to you this week comes from my sister Stephanie, who attended a writing workshop this week in Ocean Park. That's where she heard about a great word lookup site. It's at onelook.com, O-N-E-L-O-O-K.com. This site lets you look up a word conveniently at more than 1,000 dictionaries and reference sources. To try it out, I looked up the word monopoly, and I was able to do that via one link at a site called lawyers.com, a legal site. And the definition of monopoly there is, quote, exclusive control of a particular market that is marked by the power to control prices and exclude competition, and that especially is developed willfully rather than as the result of superior products or skill. So there's a good deal to consider in that definition in light of the way that the word monopoly gets bandied about these days regarding Amazon and Hachette. For the Fire Phone, I will note that it's easier to create your own lock screen than I remember it being when I first got the phone a few weeks ago. I think there's been one software update. Maybe they made that a little easier. What had been lacking was the ability to move and scale your photo to arrange it attractively on the Fire's lock screen. And I like to do that so that the date and time on the lock screen are visible and they don't interfere with an element of the photo. It's also easy when you're choosing a photo for the lock screen to just flip through all of your photos. You don't have to go back out of the lock screen selection process. You can just flip through till you find one and then make that the lock screen. What's sort of odd is, and a nice touch, is that they built in a slight 3D effect using those four camera sensors on the front of the fire, and so it's as if your photo is behind a frame on the made up by the phone body, so that as you move your head, you're looking at parts of the photo that appear to be sort of hidden by the frame, and then you move your head, it moves a little, so it gives it kind of a nice little touch. I got some great comments from some of you regarding my shift to the Fire from the iPhone 5S, so I am going to continue to give you updates on how it's going. My mood about this does seem to change from week to week, so I'm thinking of creating a Fire-o-meter ranking where one star means I give up, sign me up for an iPhone 6, to five stars, which means I have officially escaped Apple's gravitational iPhone field and will happily sail off to whatever next versions of the Fire phone Amazon invents. On that scale, this week's rating would be kind of a 3+ stars because I have pretty much solved the texting problems I was having with people that I used to text using iMessage on the iPhone. I'm also getting great sunrise photos from the Fire here at Ocean Park, and I tried out their panorama view, which worked very much like the iPhone. Did a nice job, and I like how with one quick little click on a side button, I can launch the camera and start taking photos right away. I met Jason Bogue at Book Expo America a couple of years ago in New York. This was at a discussion panel that Amazon convened to hear views on how to improve Kindle Direct Publishing. He was the publishing editor at Media Bistro at the time, leading the Alley Cat and App Newser blogs. We didn't have time to visit before or after the BEA panel, but I liked his comments at the session and hoped we'd have a chance to communicate sometime later. Well, later came this week when I heard about his new book published a month ago today on July 15th by Touchstone. That's an imprint of Simon & Schuster. I began our conversation on August 13th, 2014 by asking what led him to begin work on Born Reading, Bringing Up Bookworms in a Digital Age, from picture books to ebooks and everything in between.
Well, my daughter was born in 2010, and anyone who has a newborn knows they just sit there. They don't do very much. I didn't really know what to do with her, so I just took some of these children's books that my wife had received for her baby shower and started to read them to her. I mean, just in the first few weeks of her life, she kind of sat there. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know if it was having an effect, but it looked like she was sort of paying attention, so I kept doing it. And after about 6 months, I just had this moment where I realized that, yes, actually she was following what was going on in these books to some degree. And I could see that she was starting to very understand just the barest outline of a story. And it was really exciting for me. And I just wanted to find out why. So I started interviewing experts of all different types to find out what was going on and what was the best way to read to my daughter for the rest of her life.
So what was your goal in writing the book?
You know, it started as a very personal mission. I really wanted to know what would be the best way to read to my daughter and what would be the best books to share with her. And then as that continued, I just realized that it was something that a lot of parents were worried about. People were asking me what kind of apps they could use with their child and when was the best time to do it. And so I just started taking all of these questions that the parents around me had and shape them into a book. And once I could answer those questions for parents, I realized that it was something that could be shared with a lot more people.
The book's been out about a month. What kind of a reaction have you had so far?
The best part about it is, I get to do this weekend too, is I'm starting to go visit libraries. So I'm going to visit a library here in Los Angeles on Saturday. And I'm going to sit with parents and kids so I can show the kids and their parents the apps that I think are exciting, the digital books that I think are exciting, and then also with some print books, I can show them some of the interactive reading techniques that I talk about in the book. It's so much more exciting when you can take it off the page and share it in real life with kids and their parents. It's really magical.
Well, now, in interactive reading, that was part that really excited me in thinking about my grandson, who is 10 months old. What exactly is interactive reading?
Yeah, there are these techniques that child development experts have been researching for the last 25 years. They're proven in study after study to enrich your child. One study showed that using interactive reading techniques can increase your child's IQ by 6 points. It really just boggled my mind to read a figure like that. I couldn't understand why they weren't teaching these techniques to parents in the hospital. They're very simple. It takes maybe a half an hour out. Hour at the most to learn them. It's anything you can do to make the reading experience more participatory, to make your child an active participant in that reading experience rather than that traditional parent reads, child sits there and needs quiet model.
And a lot of it's you ask questions. Well, I'm thinking of my grandson Jake, so at 10 months, I read a book to him and I could see he would play with the pages, and it was a board book and all. But at that age, can I ask him questions meaningfully, and even though he can't answer in any way that I understand?
Oh yeah, you absolutely can. You can use pointing during that age. That's what Olive and I did, and then also we taught, and I outlined it in the book a little bit. Baby sign language works really well, especially right in that 10-month period. You can teach them very simple signs for a color or for the word more. I want to keep reading. These simple signs can just help a child communicate. And my favorite way to do it at that age is the animal sound. So if I was reading, one of my favorite books was F is for Farm by Roger Priddy, and a great book that shows different items from a farm. And I would just sit there and I would say, what sound does that chicken make? And eventually Olive could make the sound for me. I would have to fill in the blanks for a while, but it was so magical. Once she could start participating in that experience, she couldn't speak, she couldn't tell me what she was thinking, but she could make that sound. And it was really an amazing moment.
What would it look like to teach her, say, the sign to read more? How would you know when she understood she would actually make the sign and you could see her do it?
Oh, yeah. More is probably the best sign to teach a very young child. I mean, you can start when they're 6 months old. You can start practicing the sign with them. When you're sitting at the table, you just basically cup. You can look it up on the internet. There's plenty of video explanations of it. But you basically cup your fingers together and then touch them in the air. Touch them together. That's the sign language, international sign language for more. And we just taught that to Olive because it's an important thing if she wanted to eat more food or if she wanted to read more books or if she wanted more playtime. She started to use that sign really often. It was one of the very first things she communicated to us months before she could actually speak.
The other thing we mentioned, and this I think comes from LeVar Burton, that it's important to play like a child. And I think I understand how to do that wrong, because sometimes when I'm playing as a, you know, a 63-year-old would play. But how do you actually figure out or remember how to play like a child?
Yeah, there's a couple books, children's books, that really model that behavior just perfectly. One really good example is The Elephant and Piggy books by the great children's author Mo Willems. All of those books show the interactions between Elephant and Piggy, two friends who have very silly adventures. And if I flipped through them in the bookstore, I had no interest in reading them when I was reading them as an adult. But when I shared one of them with my daughter, she just tore through it and wanted more and more and more. And there's many books in this series. It was just magical to watch her respond to these little, very simple characters. The book, it makes the letters big when you're supposed to go make a noise like, oh no, I'm scared, or I'm trying to think what else. There's one point they just yell over and over, drive, drive, drivey, drive, drive. It's a very silly thing. I would have never thought to say that, but Olive repeats it when we're driving. It's one of her favorite phrases. She thinks it's hilarious. Mo Willems, it's part of his the magic. He's one of the people I interviewed in the book. He just understands what makes them laugh, and I've tried it on my daughter's entire preschool as well, and they think it's hilarious. They are rolling in the aisles at these jokes, and it will really teach you the things that kids like in books and the things that they respond to. And this book just highlights them for you. It's a master class in playing like a child.
That's amazing. It's a fascinating topic in the book about devices versus print books. And at one point you talk about the iPad fog or the iPad trance. What is that, and how do you rescue a child from it?
Yeah, well, I just want to first of all say that I use the iPad and digital devices every single day, hours and hours. It's a very important part of my work life, and it will be an important part of my daughter's life, too. And so I never wanted to keep devices away from her. But the thing is that once we did start introducing it to her, if you just leave her on the couch, she would play that device for hours. We had one very long road trip where I watched her play it for hours. I mean, we had no choice. We were trapped in this car for a long time, and we had exhausted all of our options. And we just let her play the iPad. And she would not have stopped. Children have no switch in their brain saying, you need to stop this experience and eat, or you need to stop this experience and do something else. So it's really important to have a parent there to kind of, number one, just make sure that they don't stay in that fog for too long, but also we know so much. We know how important that interactive reading experience is. And devices are very seductive. I mean, they'll read the book to your child. You don't have to do any work. You could just let the device do all the work. But it's not the same. I actually interviewed a neuroscientist about it, and he said it's not the same. A human voice is the only thing that gives you that kind of brain enrichment that you get from interactive reading. So our brains are just hardwired to respond to an adult or caregiver speaking to us that way. So we really can't lose that interactive experience.
I also have a grandson who's 8, and I've introduced him to the iPad and the Kindle Fire tablet. And my experience is that it almost seems like it's interfering with his use of the tablet when I try to do something. It's like I'm looking over his shoulder, or I'm interfering with that really powerful connection with the device. And one of the things I tried doing was we started Angry Birds, and I was playing Angry Birds on my tablet, and he was playing Angry Birds on his tablet. So we were sort of comparing notes and having a bit of a shared experience. But are there tricks to actually sharing a tablet, given that they do exert such a strong pull on an individual user?
Yeah, it's really tough. And actually, what you just described is one very good way to do it. If you can both have your experience and you show the child that you're having this together and you're talking about it, that's an interactive experience, even though you are on your separate devices. I think that's a very good idea. Other ideas, there are a few apps that are actually designed for parents or caregivers or someone else to use with a child. One really good example is one I was using with my daughter this morning. She really enjoys it. It's called Toontastic. And it's a way for them to tell stories. They make little digital movies using these digital puppets that they can steer around and record their own voices for. And it's a magical little platform that lets them create small movies, and it walks them through it. And I just sit there, and I will steer one of the puppets, and she will steer one of the puppets. And she knows that with me there's more voices in her movie. It's a better movie that she's making. So she actually asked me. She said, hey, can you do this with me today? So apps like that encourage the parent to participate. But I have to tell you, those apps are few and far between. It's hard to find them.
How old a child would still be interested in Toontastic?
It's hard to put a cap on this. I could see kids as old as 10, possibly 12, playing mm-hmm. this game. There's a version called Toontastic Junior that I started out Olive with. It's kind of a simpler version of it. I introduced her when she was 3, which is probably the absolute bottom threshold for using this app. But she really started to get it in the last year, so a 4-year-old really enjoyed the app. So it's as sophisticated as you want it to be. That's the magical thing about it. Older kids can use it. They can design their own characters to steer around. You can make your own digital puppets. You can make digital cars, all sorts of things using the tools. And you can start to add special effects and things like that. So the older kids will find other things to do. It's really a marvelous app.
You talk about the sort of the best mix of books and apps. How do you know when you've hit that sweet spot where you have the right amount of exposure to apps and the digital screens versus the physical books?
I think that's going to be different for every kid. But the moment when you know it's really working is when, I say this over and over, you have to follow what your child likes. Recently, my daughter has been on a tremendous Frozen kick. She loves Disney's Frozen. And rather than just say, okay, you can watch that video again, go ahead, I started saying, what else can I do here? So I went and we went to the bookstore together and we found the best book that Disney had produced about Frozen. It's a golden book. It's a really magical little collection. It tells the story pretty well, and she loves it. We read that fairly frequently. And then I said, what else can I do? And so I went online to Project Gutenberg, and I found The Snow Queen, the great Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale that this was based on. And I said, here, let's read this. So we read that digital book on the iPad. And then I found an old Tchaikovsky adaptation of it with music. And I said, here, let's listen to that while we drive in the car. And so we did that. And then she still watches the movie. And that was the moment. Like, I knew then that I had come up with a pretty good mix. Like, I knew she had a print book she liked, and I knew she had an audiobook that she liked, and I knew she had something on the iPad that she could do that would help expand that experience. So anything you can do to give your child more that they love, to make that experience of reading continue, and anything you can do that, that's the important thing.
And you're kind of filling out the love of a story or a topic by having access to these different media.
Yeah, no, it is wonderful. I mean, then you can go, once you've given them all of these different media things, you can go to something like Toontastic, or another good app is My Story, which lets your child actually make their own digital book online, or on the app, on the iPad. And you can say, okay, now let's continue this story. You can be like, what happens to these princesses after the movie's over? And that's the really amazing thing when you start trying to imagine what happens next.
When Olive was born, you weren't doing this research. If you knew then what you know now, are there things you would have done differently in those first few months and years of her life?
You know, I didn't learn the interactive reading techniques. I didn't learn those until, she must have been almost 1.5, 2 years old, something like that. I think if I had known, I would have been doing all of those interactive reading techniques from 6 months onward. I mean, I can't read any other way anymore. It's just become part of my life. And I think any parent that reads this book will find that. Like, once you try these interactive reading techniques, you won't want to be passive when reading a book or looking at an iPad story. You're just going to want to be a part of that experience. And I think I would have started that much sooner with Olive.
At this point, is Olive aware that you wrote a book about her reading books?
Oh yeah, yeah. She was interviewed one time by KCRW, a radio station out here, and she was really happy. She talked about, they asked what her favorite books were. She talked about how much she loved Frog and Toad, and the radio reporter accidentally said the wrong name for Frog and Toad, and Olive actually corrected her on the title. So it's really, I think that's part of this reading experience. Like, once you have this interactive reading experience, once it's part of your child's life, they're proud to talk about these books. They're proud to tell adults about it. And those skills about being able to talk about a book, it will serve them so well in life, their entire life. But it's very helpful in school, and is a really important part of preparing for school. And it's just a way to start preparing for school without having to do homework. I mean, it's a fun way to just really show your child that books are something to be appreciated and shared and discussed.
It struck me that she had such a rich experience with the interactive reading before she got to kindergarten. It made me wonder, was there any kind of a jarring confrontation with reality when she got to school, which, depending on the school, might have a more traditional view of how adults read books to children?
Unfortunately, that's a problem I don't have myself. She is at a really nice preschool right now, and the teachers are very—they're very interested in interactive reading. They invite me. I read once a week there now, and it's a really fun experience. So I don't have that problem. if your child does encounter that problem, the best way to remedy that is to go to the library. Most librarians are trained in these techniques, and a lot of teachers are too. But if your teachers aren't, go to the library. Story times will give your child that experience and kind of supplement it, the reading that you are doing at home. Just try to find it where you can, because it is a very important part of your child's reading experience, I think.
How about a child who's a reluctant reader? Have you got any favorite things to try or suggest to someone to lure them into the joy of it?
The most important thing is find out what they love. If it's the Lego movie, if it's Star Wars, whatever it is that they love. I mean, there's something, every kid has something that they love above everything else. Whatever that is, just dig into it. Find a print book about it. Find an audio book about it. Find a digital book about it. Find an app that lets them play about it. Just sample all of those different kinds of media. One of them is going to excite that child's imagination. And whatever that is, find more of that and just kind of build out based on your child's interests. Don't give them the books that you think they should be reading. Give them the books that they want to be reading. And that's really the only way to do it. And then the only other piece of advice I have with reluctant readers is just keep doing it. I mean, even if it's for 30 seconds and then they crawl away or run away, at least you are showing them the motions. Reading is a set of motions. Even people that love to read, you weren't born that way. You are a reader because your parents and the caregivers in your life took the time to read to you and taught you those motions. And everyone needs to learn them, reluctant readers and people who love to read.
I'd like to turn a little bit to the specifics of the publishing of the book. I read it on Kindle version on my Kindle Fire, my Fire phone, and there were a few links, DIY.org and digitalstorytime.com, but I found myself wishing that with all of the apps and books that you were talking about, I could have just tapped on a link and gone to buy them or get more information. In the publication process, working with Touchstone, did you have input on sort of the design of the links for the ebook version? And what did that sort of look like from the author's point of view?
Yeah, unfortunately, with the way the publication process at Simon & Schuster worked, I did not have any input on the physical ebook copy of it in this edition. Those are some very valid criticisms and ideas about how to improve it. So I'm hoping if there is future editions that I can have those conversations. I didn't actually for the Kindle, unfortunately. And so I tried to build a website that gave as many of those materials as possible to parents. That was really important to me. I tried to put all of those, I'm trying to build all those links into the website, but you're absolutely right. I wish that those could be a little more organic in the book itself.
And what's the website that you built?
It's born-reading.com.
Okay.
And I also urge anyone in the audience that wants, that's having trouble tracking down something I mentioned in the book, just email me. I'm just jasonbogue@gmail.com. I'm more than happy to interact with readers. I'm very passionate about this. I'm happy to send you links or help you find anything that I discuss in the book and guide you through it.
You had a delightful description of the joy of reading. You talk about the same cozy spot where you've been hiding since you first learned to read. I can picture a spot like that myself, but have you had any books lately that have brought you back to that cozy spot?
Yeah, I don't know if I mentioned this in the book, but I try to follow a lot of the digital use rules that I set for my daughter. And so at night, I try not to read on a digital device, or in my iPad in particular. I try not to read on when I'm going to sleep. So I usually have a book at my bedside, a print book, just because I sleep better if I don't have the device in front of my face for the last few moments of being awake. And every night, I've been reading Bartleby and Company by Enrique Villamata, who's a Spanish writer, and I have been really enjoying it. It's just these very short little, it's a novel about writers who decided to stop writing, and some of them are real and some of them are imaginary, and it's just these very short little sections, and each story is just this little peek into a writer's life, and it's really magical, and it's perfect for reading as you fall asleep.
What is all of reading these days?
Oh man, she's reading a lot of stuff. The recent thing that she's been really into is we found Fancy Nancy, which is Jane O'Connor's great series for it's for girls and boys, but it's about a girl who really wants to learn fancy vocabulary. So the book teaches you lots of big solid words while you're reading about interesting things. And so she's been reading a lot of those. And then I found at our library, I found the audiobook version. So while we drive in the morning, she will read along with Fancy Nancy and listen to the audiobooks. And she's been really into those.
That's a great title.
It's great. And then I don't know if any of your listeners use Overdrive, but we've been using it a lot more in our lives. And I can go on a Saturday morning with Olive onto Overdrive, which is a digital app for downloading books from our library. And we can sit and she can pick her next Fancy Nancy book right there. It's pretty magical.
Do you have any plans to write a follow-up book for parents and caretakers of middle school students?
I've heard that I'll have to see how it turns out in our own lives, but I've heard that you face a whole new set of struggles once you hit middle school and middle grade readers. So maybe, but I'll definitely have to see how it happens in our own lives as well, because doing it with Olive was what made this book so important for me. And then also, I think it just made it stronger as an experience. So I would have to go there with Olive. So I'm going to wait and see how she turns out.
Is there anything that we haven't talked about you'd like to mention?
No, I just want to reiterate people should visit the website. I'm trying to build all of the things there. It's born-reading.com. And please email me if you have any questions. I am more than happy to help you find any of the resources that I mentioned in the book.
I have been speaking with Jason Bogue, author of Born Reading, Bringing Up Bookworms in a Digital Age, from picture books to e-books and everything in between. Thanks very much, Jason.
Thank you, Len. It's been a real pleasure.
After doing the interview, I found the KCRW interview that Jason and Olive did with Lisa Napoli on August 1st. That's out in L.A. And I want to play you the part where that he discusses in the interview where Olive corrects the reporter's reference to a book.
What are your favorite books?
The Berenstain Bears.
Berenstain Bears. Yeah, that's a classic. How about, what else?
Amelia Bedelia.
Amelia Bedelia.
What do you listen to in the car?
Frog and Toad.
Oh, Frank and Toad. So you like...
No, Frog and Toad.
Frog and Toad. Don't know that one. Wow.
It has a lot of stories.
Lots of stories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want to finish with a snippet that I recorded here at the cottage this morning when my grandson Jake came by to visit with his mother, my daughter Rue, and her husband and Jake's dad, Mike. You can tell this family is doing lots of reading as my grandson turns 10 months. In fact, today is his 10-month birthday. And I look forward to trying out Jason's interactive reading techniques when I have a chance to read to Jake during the rest of their stay here at Ocean Park and beyond. He likes to chew on his board books, and he's easily distracted by our Yorkie Claire, but I feel confident his early encounters with reading are sinking in.
Claire.
Yellow duck, yellow duck. What do you see? I see a blue horse looking at me. Blue horse, what do you see? I see a green frog looking at me. Because you're going to edit this, right?
Yeah.
Because you can make it make sounds. Jake, ah! Ah! Purple cat, what do you see? I see a white dog looking at me. La la.
He's looking all around the room.
Oh! White dog, what do you see? I see a black sheep.
To go along with this week's theme of books for young readers, I am going to have a link to a list of 100 children's books to read in a lifetime that was compiled by the book editors at Amazon, led by Sarah Nelson. The list is full of nostalgic favorites like Harold and the Purple Crayon, as well as newer releases. The list is full of nostalgic favorites like Harold and the Purple Crayon, as well as newer releases such as The Day the Crayons Quit. The list as it appears at Amazon.com contains kind of fun subtitles on each book that make it enjoyable to explore. For example, A Wrinkle in Time by Madeleine L'Engle is titled The 60s Kid Classic. A Favorite of My Wife Darlene's Don't Let the Pigeons Drive the Bus by Mo Willems is titled One Funny Bird. Each listing has easy links to the print, Kindle, and audiobook formats. Over on Goodreads, readers ranked these 100 books according to their own favorites, and the final result is in. It shows Harry Potter by J.K. Rowling at the top of the list, no surprise there, followed by Charlotte's Web by E.B. White, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis, and Where the Wild Things Are by Maurice Sendak. That's the top four. Finally, in content, I want to mention a couple of good book discovery sources that have been launched by publishers. The first is from Simon & Schuster, and it's called Off the Shelf. You can find the latest posts at offtheshelf.com, and you can also subscribe to a free email newsletter. Here's how they describe their mission. Off the Shelf is a site and newsletter created by passionate editors, authors, and others inside the book business to help you discover or rediscover great books. Whether they're bestsellers you never got a chance to read or classics you remember falling for when you first read them, the books we write about have made an indelible impression on us as readers and have become friends we revisit often. We hope that shining a new light on these wonderful books will help you discover a passion for them too. What I like about Off the Shelf is the editorial content. There are blog posts by authors on interesting subjects, lists of books that make it fun to discover books, and a very nice clean layout. It reminds me of the good job that the book subscription startup Oyster is doing, collecting books in fun categories and making it just a visual joy to browse around their offerings. Another great source is the ebook publisher Open Road Media's newsletter. That one is titled The Open Road Reader. You can subscribe by email, and once the latest edition arrives in your inbox, you can click to a web view. The tagline for this newsletter is Curated for Book Nerds Everywhere, and the editor, Julie Blatberg, has accepted an invitation to be my guest for TKC 317 on August 29th. Open Road has other newsletters, so you can tailor what you receive to your interests. They are Early Bird Books, which tell you about discounted and free books with new deals every day. The Murder and Mayhem newsletter, there's one called Romancing the Reader, and a fourth named Open Road Media Young Readers. These all look to be enjoyable to read and handsomely designed. I am partial to Open Road because of the terrific interview I had with its CEO, Jane Friedman, last fall. One of her memorable assertions was, quote, "Books represent civilization. Books will exist forever in whatever format." Open Road is also making more than 4,000 of its titles available in the Kindle Unlimited program, which is a great enhancement of Amazon's new monthly all-you-can-eat book subscription for $9.99 a month. I'd like to turn now to some comments. This one comes from Dave Ball. Dear Len, I just wanted to drop you a note about Kindle Unlimited. While I'm not sure it's for everyone, I will get a lot of use out of it. It has quite a few excellent Kindle singles. It's also chock full of how-tos for my new Mac. I will save money with the service for a good while. It has an interesting history section as well. What it's short on is newer novels and recent editions. This makes sense to me since I regard it as a backlist selection. For what it does, I think Kindle Unlimited performs quite well. I give it a solid B+. And from Dan Myers, hi Len, regarding the person from the UK requesting a 6-inch Kindle Fire, that was Eolake Stubblehouse. Dan writes, it's not surprising that he likes the 6-inch screen, since to my knowledge that has been the size of every e-ink Kindle Amazon has made except for the Kindle DX. My 2 cents for a workaround until Amazon makes a color 6-inch screen would be to purchase a used cell phone with 5.5 or 6-inch screen. From looking around on Google, it looks like a Samsung Galaxy Note 2 5.5-inch screen can be purchased used for about $200. One could just not activate the phone part and use it as a Kindle reader. Al from Bardstown, Kentucky, weighed in on the demise of the Sony e-reader business. I was reading e-books on my Palm Pilot TX and had discovered Bane Books. The new Sony reader came out, and in typical Sony style, they mismarketed the whole thing. First, they gave the sole sales outlet to a brick-and-mortar store, rhymes with quarters, that had little interest in selling their readers. I was living near Spokane, Washington, and the closest of their stores that actually had a Sony reader on site was in Seattle. That is way on the other side of the state. Next, they would order a reader for you, but if you didn't like it, then your only option was to either throw it in the trash or sell it on eBay. Also, they had a proprietary format that was not compatible with any other formats. Since all my ebooks were DRM-free, I could have them converted them to the Sony format, but why should I have to? Then, about a year after trying to get the Sony, Amazon popped up with buy ours, free shipping, send it back within 30 days, also free shipping if you don't like it. There was no reason to not try that out. I ordered one in the second shipment, which was a few weeks after the first one was sold out in hours. When I got it, the first thing I did was load the PRC ebook onto the Kindle that I was reading on the Palm. It loaded just fine. I searched my Palm for a word that seemed unique and then searched the Kindle for the same word. I found two hits, chose the most obvious, and was continuing to read that Bane book on the Kindle in just a few minutes. I had decided that I was going to keep the Kindle before the day was out. Now that is marketing. I am now on my fourth Kindle Plus afire. That's all for this week. This is Len Edgerly for the Kindle Chronicles in Ocean Park, Maine. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.